Hey everybody, and welcome to episode 73 of the epic linear A Song of Ice and Fire reread from Vassals of Kingsgrave. My name's Bina 007 and I'll be your host today, and I am joined by Michael.
Hey, Kawa Degi on the forums.
By Mary.
Hello, it's now Mary on the forums.
By Adam.
That's my name, don't wear it out. Also Jon Snow.
By Matt.
Varley on the forums.
And sadly, Sir Patrick the Tall, greetings mortals, could not join last minute. Okay, so in the last episode, we ended with Sam figuring out the truth about Gilly's baby in Sam 2 on March 2nd. In this episode, we cover Arya 2 from Feast, Jon 4 and Davos 3 from Dance. The events, well, not so much take place, but begin between March 7th and March 12th. Two of the chapters we're doing today cover kind of quite a long period of time. So the first one of those is Arya 2 from Feast. It's kind of like a super long training montage. After Sam 2, we jump forward six chapters and 90 pages to Arya 2. It begins on March 7th, and it's Michael with a chapter summary.
All right. So Arya begins her training in the House of Black and White as a servant, sweeping floors, serving at meals, and finding those in the temple who have died. People come into the house and either pray, seek the counsel of one of the priests, or drink from the black fountain to sleep and never wake up. Two priests live in the temple, the kindly man and a thin little girl known as the waif, along with three acolytes, two servants, and a cook. Each night, Arya says the names of the people she wants to kill. Sir Gregor, Dunsan, Raff the Sweetling, Sir Ilan, Sir Meryn, and Queen Cersei. One day, she is questioned by the kindly man over these names. Arya is told that to become a true servant of the Faceless Men, she must forget the desires of Arya Stark and become no one. She is offered other paths in life, as a courtesan of Braavos, a rich merchant's servant, or to have a husband of her choosing, but Arya refuses. To prove herself, the kindly man says she must discard all the things belonging to Arya Stark. At night, she leaves the House of Black and White and throws her possessions into a canal. Her clothes, the coin she still has, and all the gifts she received from the Braavosi sailors, stopping only at Needle. Arya tells herself that Needle is just a sword, but it wasn't. Needle was Hodor and Old Man, Winterfell's grey walls, the heart tree of the Godswood, and Jon Snow's smile. She cannot bring herself to throw it away and instead hides Needle in a stone on the steps of the temple. Afterwards, the kindly man tells her the tale of the Faceless Men. They began in the mines of Valyria beneath the 14 fires and were captured slaves of 100 different nations, toiled and suffered for the Valyrians' pursuit of treasure. They prayed to 100 different gods for an end to their suffering, whereupon a man of unknown origins realized that they all prayed to one god, not 100, and that he was their instrument. His first gift of death was to the most wretched of slaves, which shocks Arya, who says that he should have killed the masters. The kindly man replies that he would, but that is a tale for another time. Arya is given a cowl of an acolyte and sent to the waif to learn the Braavosi language. When her Braavosi becomes passable, she is told to take up with Brusco the fishmonger, so she can master the language and learn the ways of Braavos. Arya chooses a new name of Kat, an orphan from King's Landing who arrived on the ship Nymeria, and leaves for the canals, chanting the names of those she wants dead. Sir Gregor, Dunsan, Raff the Sweetling, Sir Ilan, Sir Meryn, and Queen Cersei.
Very good.
All right. So what do we think of this one? This is quite a long chapter.
It is really long, isn't it?
You sound unimpressed, Matt.
I am.
I really enjoyed it, because I think the end of the last Arya chapter where she eats the maggot out of the eye of the guy sent to scare her was awesome. And this is yet more information about one of the religions or cults in this world that has been the most mysterious. And we're starting to get inducted into, you know, you get their origin story, which is kind of cool, from Valyria. You get fireworms, which is awesome, and just general mayhem. And you get Arya trying to be not as Stark and sort of failing. The terminology really freaked me out when she starts talking about her family and she refers to Sansa as, there's a line, the others couldn't have been much older than Sansa, who had been her sister. And it's like, wow, she's really trying to put them aside. So I really love this chapter. And the other thing I noticed, probably for the first time, which is really ridiculous because it's fairly obvious, is I hadn't realized that people were going into the temple and, you know, saying a day or a month or a year of prayers and drinking from this weird poisonous pool and just committing euthanasia or self-euthanasia. And that's where all the corpses come from. So that was kind of radical to me.
Yeah, isn't it just suicide?
Suicide booth.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of killing themselves effectively. kind of pretty radical.
So in this chapter, you get to kind of see behind the curtain of the Faceless Men. But like in every book leading up to this, they're supposed to be like these like massively rich badasses that like, you know, that every time they're brought up, they're like, well, you know, it would cost more than a fortune to hire a Faceless Man. But it sounds like it's kind of against or counter their religion just to kill someone for money.
I think
I get the impression in this chapter, sorry, Marie, that if you want to make a contract, you want someone killed, you go to these people and they ask you a percentage of your wealth, like a lot of, depending on how rich you are. So it's like they ask all of you. And so in one case, the dude had to give up 2/3 of his wealth and his own daughter for the assassination contract to go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's it shouldn't be easy to just go to these guys and be like, can you kill that guy? Because I don't really like him. So it costs a lot. It costs a lot, but maybe not in actual money, depending on the people. But that's more explained in later chapters, I think.
Well, then why was Littlefinger all like, it cost a fortune? The realm was bankrupt. If it was like
because
half
for,
of...
them, for them, for a kingdom to pay for the assassination of someone, that would require a lot of money or a lot of sacrifice.
The kingdom has no money.
Yeah, well, that's a point. But it is a big entity, you know, so you should expect that they will ask a lot for an assassination. And we can also just maybe just Littlefinger doesn't quite know how the Faceless Men work. It doesn't seem to be very clear to Westeros what this... I mean, they don't even see it as a religion in Westeros, more as a group of...
A guild
assassins.
Of assassins.
An
yeah,
assassin
exactly.
organization, yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Actually, to Pino's point, I think there's a great contrast in this chapter. Like there are times where Arya is trying to get rid of her feelings. She's really it's almost like she has no emotions, and that's really sad. And then when she smells the candle and remembers Winterfell, or when she thinks about what Needle represents for her, there's a big list of things and people and memories that just come up. And it was really striking to me how like she still feels a lot of those things. It's just it has to be something like a scent or trying to get rid of Needle for her to feel these things again. And this chapter makes me sad, really. Like it's interesting, the whole Faceless Men thing is interesting, but it's also it's also so sad that they have to abandon everything they are to their god, and that we see Arya going down that path, even though she still is a Stark and she cannot quite get rid of her identity. I have mixed feelings about this. I want to see her be a badass warrior, and even I could be excited about her being an assassin, but identity-less assassin is tough.
What do we think the future holds? Is she going to completely go down this path, or do we think her Stark identity will reassert itself?
I mean, it has to, right? That's the whole point of, like, you know, now it's like Chekhov's needle, like, hidden under that stair, so.
Right.
Yeah, if you look at how many times her Stark identity comes back, like, even at the very end, she's like, oh, I'm going to be Kat after her mother, and I came on the ship Nymeria. It's like, yeah, the kindly man obviously doesn't notice this, but yeah, it should be obvious to us.
Which is weird, because the kindly man notices everything. Like, how does he not see that this is Arya poking through?
Well, he's not omnipotent. He doesn't necessarily
know.
Right,
and I mean, I think everyone else that goes through this, it's kind of the same thing, right? Like, they don't go, like, 0 to 60, right? It's not like they flip a switch and they suddenly become no one. I think it's a process that takes years, and he recognizes that.
So, Arya asks about Jaqen again, and he's like, I do not know this man. Like, what? Like, obviously, he could have taken a different name, but, like, doesn't he know, like, oh, yeah, the assassin that's over in Westeros? Like, I don't
Well, maybe
understand.
There's more than one.
Melisandre is a faceless man.
There was that dude in the Iron Islands who kills Baelin, or a chick. And so some people think it might be Jaqen H'ghar. Some people think it was a separate faceless man. So there's likely multiple faceless men running around in Westeros.
Right. And the names that they take, though, can also be, like, unknown to the people in the House of Black and White, right? I mean, like, well, you can change your name pretty quickly once you've gone across, you know, the ocean. So he may legitimately just not know the name.
Yeah, but, I mean, it sounds like they have a good, like, you know, conference call debriefing before and after, like, these kind of hit squads, you know? Like,
yeah.
Get all, what was it, the, like, the good-looking the man and man. Starved man and the fat man.
Well, I don't think Jack and Hagar, or the man known as Jack and Hagar, has returned yet from his assignment, whatever that might be.
Right. Well, we know he hasn't returned yet because he's still Pate, right? At the end of the book, when Sam gets to the Citadel?
Yeah, he's like in a long-term assignment doing something.
He's deeply embedded.
So, has anyone heard the theory that the Faceless Men caused the Doom of Valyria?
Right, because isn't it that they killed all the priests that were supposed to keep the fires, like, under wraps, just like something like
prevented
that?
Prevented all the volcanoes from exploding, yeah.
Because
there's a bit of textual hint here when the kindly man obviously says, oh, he would give the gift to them, but I'll tell you that later when you're at a higher level or whatever.
Once you've gone through more auditing.
Yeah. what do you think that means towards their interaction with Daenerys? Because she's like, you know, the breaker of chains, so she's against slavery, but again, she's like this going to be this emblem of Valyria of old with her dragons and like the ruthless power that she can hold with them. What do you think the Faceless Men's...
I kind of get the impression that her anti-slavery stance tops the dragon stance. So, like, Braavos was founded as a city of freedmen. And, you know, on that canal thing, they have all men are free, not we fucking hate dragons. So they probably don't like that she has dragons, but the fact that she's freeing so many slaves and basically doing the opposite of old Valyria, I think they'll be like, all right, let's not kill her. She's cool.
Bina, you love dragons. What do you think?
I don't like dragons, and yet, curiously, I'm not pissed off with the concept of fireworms. I think it's because it sounds like it's from something from Dune.
So what were they digging in the caves, like mithril or something?
Gold and silver and maybe spice.
Spice?
The spice must flow. That's why there's worms there.
Like synthetic pot spice? No, that makes you like eat people's faces.
It was a Dune reference.
Like the kind of spice that Han Solo, the drug dealer, steals.
Huh. I've never read Dune, so I'm lacking knowledge.
Shame.
Mm.
I had a question. So, like, one of the recurring things in this chapter is, who are you? No one. No, you're still Arya of House Stark. So, and every time they confront her to that and they say, you are lying. So is the point for her to actually feel like she's no one, or is it for her to be better about lying about being no one? Like, do you see my point? Because they are also encouraging her to lie better and to control her face. And so does it mean she actually has to feel like she's no one?
Or are the two mutually exclusive?
Not necessarily. Just, no. Yeah, you're right. It could be both.
I'm assuming she's like a really bad liar.
Yeah, I mean, you fake it until you make it, kind of. And eventually you actually start to feel it. I mean, that's usually how most things work. And I think that's probably where they start is, you know, you have to start, you know, if you can convince me that you at least believe you're no one or you're on the way there, then you're going to be able to convince other people. And then eventually maybe you just believe it and you're, you know, you become like the old man.
Yeah.
So in the chapter, they bring up, like, they see the bodies go down to the lower sanctums and they never see them again. And then Arya's, like, sitting there eating pork and she's like, wait a minute.
I love that little thing.
So do you think she's actually eating human? Like, no. Bran ate human?
No.
I think the kindly man tells her, nah, it's just pork. Don't worry.
Yeah, but isn't that something he would say?
I believe him. I don't know, there's a lot of
cannibalism in these books. I don't know.
Yeah, hidden cannibalism. It's always like, yeah, it's, and they just call them pork.
Or not so hidden at, like, Harrenhal.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But they call that goat, right?
I get the sense that the Faceless Men are very civilized. So eating human flesh seems beyond them.
But they are assassins. I mean, like, civilized, meh. Just because they're
classy.
Just because they have all
the classy assassins.
I just think that it's all kind of propaganda, isn't it? Syria Forel, we're water dancers, and, you know, like Jack and Gar are just so, and it's all very elegant, but underneath, it's a place where people go to get hits on people. It's just the mafia. It's just the Sopranos.
Yeah,
so,
it's Murder, Inc.
Yeah, it's Murder, Inc. And
how dare you question their noble deeds?
They're not noble at all. I mean, it's just paid for. There's no assessment of whether the person deserves to die or not.
They just dress it up by saying
that the faceless god decides. It's not up to you to decide who gives or takes a life. But it sort of is, because you decide the price they're going to pay and whether they can afford it. So I think it's just bollocks, isn't it?
Right. They just try to make themselves seem like on the side of good, or like they're doing some kind of service. But no, they're just getting paid to kill people.
Yeah, and as much as we talk about in this world, like, you know, who actually has a connection to the gods or whatever, there's no real evidence that, like, the faceless god, nameless god it's not like they actually have a line to him, and, you know, so.
It's more a concept than an actual
god. It's just that death comes for everyone, and that's why they...
They make decisions like most people do. Yeah.
They do have an ideology behind it. I mean, you might think it's hypocrisy and bullshit, but it feels to me like at least some of them actually believe in that ideology.
I'm sure they believe it, but then believing it doesn't mean, like, when they say, like, well, you know, yeah, the nameless god, you know, picks someone, doesn't mean like it's anything more than them just coming up with this shit.
No,
you
know? I agree, but my point is that, yeah, it's brutal, but it doesn't seem to be barbaric, and I don't like I it just everything we see about the faceless men here makes me want to say that they wouldn't be cannibals on top of it, but maybe I'm wrong. It's just the feeling I have.
Unless there's some sort of religious, you know, connection to like eating the flesh of people who've given themselves or something.
So why, because we get like the whole faceless god dump here, why did Jack and Hagar say that the red god was denied two lives, like in Game of Thrones, the first book, to Arya? And that's why, or three lives or whatever, and that's why he owed her three deaths.
Because they nearly got burnt to death, I think, in the shed.
Yeah, and the many face god is supposed to be representing all of the gods, I guess, from their point of view.
You could argue that maybe in A Clash of Kings, George hadn't figured out the ideology and stuff of the faceless men yet. That is one possibility.
Yeah. No.
Well, I mean, he had to have had like some idea. He had Jaqen give Arya the coin.
Well, it's a coin of Braavos.
But I mean, like, some people don't go that far ahead when they're writing. Some people, you know, have a loose idea and they make it up as they go. And I mean, I think George is more of the kind that plans things out a little better, but even he has his limits, you know, 20-something years ago.
He has his limits now, but we can talk about that after.
Do we really have wide to? I feel like hips. We're doing that every time now.
But yeah, I'm gonna cite the Victorian volcano arm defense in that the faceless men can change their faces, so they're cool. They're awesome by default.
Chewbacca is a Wookiee. If this makes any sense, you must acquit.
Chewbacca lives on Endor. You must acquit.
Anything else in the episode? I mean, not the episode, the chapter even.
Well, I mean, like, I'm surprised we haven't really talked much about the part where, you know, Arya is throwing all of her stuff away. That's kind of one of the better scenes in these books for
me. And gets butt
naked,
because... apparently, which is just slightly weird.
Yeah, which you forget. You got this,
and then
like,
she,
you know,
only
10,
gets clothed like a day later. Nice nude soft leather and linen understuff. And you just think, was it necessary for her to take off even her small clothes, George?
Well, they belong to Arya, so, you know. Mm. Yeah, but I mean, the fact that she keeps Needle, and like, you know, every time I think, well, you know, like she throws her coin in, and I'm like, you know, you could have donated that or something. That's kind of a waste. But otherwise...
Yeah, aren't
you
supposed to, like, pass that along?
She keeps because she won't get rid of it. She has to get rid of everything that's to do with her. Like, he didn't say, you know, it has to all go to waste, but I guess, you know, it was kind of hard for her to do, so she just was kind of determined and had to do it. But in the end, she couldn't get rid of Needle, and I like how she kind of remarks that, like, well, it's not even a real sword, it's kind of pointless, but it's kind of part of her soul, and she just can't get rid of it, and of course, that'll come up later. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the better scenes, because we realize that, like, she's still this child, she's still... connected to her past as much as she tries to, you know, she's trying to kind of just get away and move on. Like, that's maybe not going to be successful.
Yeah, that Arya Stark, it's definitely coming back.
Well, yeah, because doesn't she get the midget, the, fuck, what's her name? Ghost of Hornhill? Doesn't she, like, oh, I thought it was the Lord that stunk like death, but it's you. So, like, she's about to go on a tear, I think, thanks to Faceless Men training.
I'll be interested to see how the Faceless Men respond to this, because I get the impression they don't tolerate rogue agents, and, you know, doesn't suggest her life prognosis is going to... she's going to have a long lifespan or anything. I hope she does, but yeah, I'm worried about the consequences.
Do you think they might be a little put off because she's like a little too good already for a 10-year-old?
What, like, she's a straight-up killer?
Yeah.
I think they'd be down for it. They'd be game if she turns on them, you know. They're gentlemen with standards. They can't handle it when anyone breaks that.
Hmm.
Okay. Anything else on the chapter? I mean, I think it's a really cool chapter. There's lots of great world building in detail, but maybe nothing that's too sort of crazy and theory worthy in there.
How much time passes here? Is it like 3 months or more? Because it's like the moon turned and turned again or something. I get the impression a lot of time passes here.
Yeah. Let me just open up the Redditor's spreadsheet.
Well, I know that like this chapter is chapter, what, 7? And her next chapter is chapter 35. So there's quite a bit of time.
Yeah, I think there's quite a lot of discussion about the time frame of this chapter, but also I guess it has to coincide. I mean, when Sam and Daeron and Gilly and Aemon arrive to Braavos, it has to coincide at some point. So you can, I guess, try to go from there, but it's at least 2 or 3 months, I think.
Yeah.
Which seems weird, because Sam is already gone, right? Yeah, has already left, so you can. He's not gonna spend that long at sea, I don't think, but maybe. I mean, that's the kind of thing where you can expect that it's difficult to actually put a very precise date.
The thing that struck me reading this and having the timeline open is that in previous books, it's always been Dany who's had maybe just 3 or 4 chapters, but broadly spread out, sprinkled over a book. And they're always these big not baggy chapters, but chapters that cover, you know, a fairly long time period where mm-hmm. we catch up on all the events. And it feels that in Feast, because obviously Dany's not in it, Arya performs that service, that she's off in a slightly different place and having these sort of catch-up chapters that happen widely spaced and bring us up to speed. So it's kind of interesting to see that she's adopted that space that Dany used to have.
Yeah.
What do you think Arya's training montage music would be? I'm going Separate Ways by Journey.
I mean, it's always Rocky music, isn't it? I mean, training montage is always... It's
the training music from Rocky IV when he's in Russia.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good one.
The Surviving Heart or whatever it's called, yeah.
Yeah. Although, isn't there a spoof training montage music thing in Team America World Police?
Yes, which is the best.
And South Park, and they're great.
So, after Arya 2, we go back to Jon 4 in Dance of Dragons. It takes place, at the start of this chapter, of the Arya chapter, it takes place at the same time as that, on March the 8th, 300. And I believe it's Mary with a chapter summary.
Yep. Here we go. So, underneath Castle Black and the Wall, Jon accompanies Bowen Marsh to check on the food stores. Grain, cheese, carrots, turnips, ham, sausages, spices, onions, cabbages, frozen carcasses, and no potatoes, apparently. Well, it seems like a lot of food to Jon, but Marsh is worried. Winter is coming, and they don't have enough to feed the Watch, Stannis' men, and the Wildlings. Jon agrees to cut down food portions by a quarter, but Marsh fears it won't be enough. With the war, it's unlikely food will come by the King's Road, and even if someone was willing to sell them food, they wouldn't have the gold to buy it. Maybe the Eyrie could help, but it would be somewhat ironic for Lady Catelyn's sister to feed Ned Stark's bastard. Well, a ranger suggests hunting, but Marsh advises against sending hunters out, as one could expect. Half the Watch actually agrees with him about sealing the gates, and the other sides with Jon. The Lord Commander argues that they cannot stop the King's men from taking the food anyway, and the Wildlings must be fed. They will find a way, he says, but Marsh is skeptical. Once at the surface and outside, they find Devon Seaworth. The king commands John's presence. The Wrongway Rangers have returned. The squires brings John to the king. Justin Massey and Richard Hope are there among other queensmen, as well as the new Magnar of Thames and Rattleshirt. The Lord of Bones is wearing a glimmering red gem. Stannis gives Rattleshirt to John since he asked for men, and Melisandre promises that the gem bounds him to her and that he will stay true. John has nothing but despise for the Lord of Bones, but now is not the time, because apparently it's time for Northern politics. Half the Umbers have joined Bolton, the other half might join Stannis if he gives them Mans Raider's call. All the other houses except Carstark seem to have joined Bolton. Ramsay has left the Dreadfort to march on Maud Canaan, and Stannis plans to take the Dreadfort in the meantime. Words are not swords, and despite the whole taking no part thing, John warns Stannis that he won't be able to take the Dreadfort quickly, whereas Maud Canaan will fall swiftly and he will be cut out from retreat by both Ramsay and Roose Bolton. The King's Knights protest and argue of the strength of their army, and see how they cut through the Wildings? And actually, they'll take the same Wildings with them, so it's all good. They can take the Dreadfort. By the way, they will also need swords and armor from the Watch's armory. Well, words might not be swords, but swords are swords, and Jon deflects however he can and advises Stannis to leave the Wildings at the Wall if he wants any hope of bringing the North to his cause. The king dismisses everyone except John and Mel, and once again offer the North to John, who once again refuses. Fair enough. Stannis means to give Winterfell to Arnold Carstark anyway, or Morth Umber if he helps taking the Dreadfort. John argues that Stannis could still win the Manderlys to his cause, since their banner was not among those who joined the Bolton, according to Melisandre's fires. But Stannis has had no news of Davos and doesn't believe Lord Tufat will join him. He must win the North by battle. John realizes he won't budge, and despite his vows to take no part, he tries one last thing. If the king will leave the Wildlings at the Wall, he will tell him where to find more men. 3,000 men. Stannis agrees and John tells him of the mountain clans of the North. Proud men, but they will be loyal if he honors them by going himself and asking them to fight for him. But fight where and whom? Well, if Bolton wants to fight the Iron Men, so must Stannis. And John tells him he should take Deepwood Moss. The king is convinced, and John finds himself with 1,000 wildlings to feed, and Mel, who decided to stay at the Wall. And that's it.
That was a tough one. Tower of the Hand doesn't even have a recap for that.
Oh, by now I've had to stop using Tower of the Hand and using the Westeros.org summaries. Tower of the Hand, I just don't understand why they've never finished their chapter summaries. It's like, guys, there have been no new books. Get on it. What are you doing? Did they just stop? I'm not really that involved with Tower of the Hand.
Yeah, I hadn't noticed it until recently.
Yeah. Is it an active site? Has it just tailed off? I mean, I know people from the VOC community do post essays on there and stuff, but...
You mean Valgrist?
Well, didn't Michael Carl Wodeki posted an essay recently? Yeah, it's not just Valkyrus, Mac.
Sorry, yeah, Matt.
Sorry, Cal.
Mary. So no one knows why Tower of the Hand isn't. Is it going to finish, or is it just not finished?
I don't know.
I bet if we you know, went around like the forums or something over there, maybe we could figure it out. But we're not really connected.
Okay, sorry, Mary. Back to the chapter.
There was a few things that I didn't put on my recap that I thought were important in this chapter. So firstly, there's ghosts, because in recent chapters, John seemed more connected to ghosts and more aware of his wolf dreams. But right here, he refuses that ghosts come with him, and we know that it's not going to be good for the following. So that seemed like an interesting little thing in this chapter. And I also liked how he described him. The words are silence on 4 feet. And I found that amazing.
I like the image of him poking around at who's Davos's son, Devon the Squire. And the Squire's so scared that he can't move. And that was good. It made me laugh.
So do you think that they're running out of provisions because of the wars and the Northern Lords were like busy down south fighting instead of giving like more food to the wall?
Yeah, I think the point is that they have quite a lot of food, but that would have been okay for a short winter with the possibility of food coming up the King's Road. And it's complicated by the fact that they have Stannis and his men and all the wildlings to feed.
And zero support coming from the south as of now.
I feel really bad for John. I just think he's really... There are no good options here.
Does Cersei not send any more support with like her 100 cutthroats or whatever that she sends to the wall?
I don't think she ever gets around to that. It's one of Cersei's, oh, this is a cool idea, but then she never thinks about it again.
It's her plan to send Osni, right?
Right, like a Kettle Black with like a bunch of other guys to seem like the South is supporting the wall, but...
Yeah, but he gets trapped in the whole thing with the Faith and prison and all that, so...
Was it him or one of his brothers? Oh, yeah, I guess it was him, because it'd be like, oh, well, you fucked the queen, so you can take the black.
Well, yeah, that was the whole thing, is she needed a reason to send him to the wall, too, right?
Yeah. Right.
But, yeah, I get the sense that, like, King's Landing, like, Tywin and Cersei, they've just forgotten about the Night's Watch, and, yeah, it's getting neglected.
Yeah,
clearly. Yeah, which isn't even the result of war, that's just as it has been probably for the last 50 years or so.
Right.
Yeah, I think for most of the recent history, it's mostly the Northern Lords who've helped the Watch, since they are the first one to actually suffer at the Wildlings' raids, and now that the Starks are basically extinct, at least apparently, and that it's just chaos, including in the north, I assume. Yeah,
and I'm guessing that, like, you know, during the time of war, it's easier to conscript a rapist or a thief or something than send them to the wall, right?
Yeah,
I mean, that's why I do quite like these three chapters together. I think are quite fun, because you've got Arya trying, who is still alive as a Stark, but trying not to be and kind of failing, and then you have Jon, who sort of isn't,
he could really, be the Stark.
He could be the only Stark standing. He's being tempted by Stannis in his 40 days in the wilderness to say, go on, become a Stark and take on that mantle. And then you have Davos kind of from another angle, seeing what happens when there are supposedly no Starks in the north, and that, you know, all the different northern families are backing different factions. And you've got Manderly very aggressively saying he's doing one thing when we suspect he's doing another. But I feel that the link with all these three chapters is... What happens when there are no Starks, and what are the existing children? What is their reaction to it? What is the reaction of the northern houses? So it's kind of cool, I think, that, you know, even though these chapters aren't meant to be together, you can always find the crazy links between them.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, it's the same thing as when there's a power vacuum in any level. Like, there's going to be bickering to see who can become top dog, and that usually involves fighting and bloodshed, and... I think that's what we're seeing, right?
I think it's also a matter of how this power vacuum came to be. I guess we can discuss that more with the Davos chapter, but this is new. Like, the fact that Rob was clearly assassinated at a wedding by his own allies, that hasn't really happened before. So it's also why it's such chaos. Because, I mean... If he had been defeated, like, in an honorable way, if I may say, that would be totally different. But
yeah, like, Torrhen Stark bent the knee to the Targaryens and, like, you know, maintained his power, just not as king of the North, but, you know, but kind of kept the Stark name. But
I do find it's funny when you see Karl Stark referred to here as, you know, the new Lord of Winterfell, and you think in exactly the next Davos chapter, Manderly's like, he's only a Castellan. Which actual lords do you have?
Yeah.
Which is really funny. So the news obviously hasn't gotten out yet.
I think also that Stannis is trying to just assert his power to Jon, and that's a way to be okay. You don't want Winterfell? Fine, I have other men to give it to. He just mentions Karl Stark because that's one of the few he has.
It's also funny on a reread to know that the Karstarks are actually double agents and that they're in the employ of the Boltons. Yeah. And this will later be revealed by Elise Karstark. And I think he keeps writing to Stannis saying, "Oh, you should attack the Dreadfort. It's lightly held." And that's actually a trap.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Oh, geez. Yeah, so Arnoff is the twisted guy, right? That is the traitor. Right.
He hobbles around. So yeah, he's got like a twisted shoulder or something.
Yeah. Huh.
And again, that might be revealed in the Theon chapter of Winds. So maybe, but I'm not sure.
Oh no! Like, it's revealed. It's revealed before when Elise.
I meant. But what I'm just going to say, the Embers, they're also like kind of working both sides. Like it's explained here that half the family is with the Bolton and the Boltons, and half is just still hesitating to go to Stannis.
Isn't half only with the Boltons because the Big John is being held by the Freys?
Well, that's what John says here. But isn't it also that this way to have men in both sides, and when it's time for the battle, they can actually shift sides?
Mm. Yeah, I guess
that was the impression I got. That to an extent, they're sort of having some just going there, so they've got spies or an opportunity to betray if the opportunity comes up.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess same as Manderly, they want to keep the great John alive too.
Yeah.
I loved when John thinks about, when Melisandre talks about what she saw in the flames and everything, and she's like, "The flames do not lie," and John is thinking, "Well, perhaps not, but you do," and I just love this, yeah.
Yeah, this feisty John.
Yeah.
So, the Mountain Clans, they don't sound very, they sound pretty uncouth, right? They just need to be placated to, you know, have them join your side.
But everyone needs to be placated, right? I don't think they're hugely different. I mean, like, what is Frey except an ego? I mean, a lot of these grand houses and all the vengeance we see in A Song of Ice and Fire is basically, you know, people who've had their ego pricked and now want...
But even...
You know, they're just the same. It's just they're harder to access and they're up goat trails that need, you know, decent mountain horses and donkeys to get to.
But isn't... Oh shit, what's her name? Asha? The Asha chapters they seem like they would have been on board without, you know, it wouldn't have taken much. They could have been like, "Hey, you want to go fight the Boltons?" I'd be like, "Yeah, fuck those guys." Like Big Bucket, who's the best fucking character ever. doesn't he say like he wants to die with like the blood of Boltons on his tongue and stuff like that?
When I heard the name Big Bucket, who I'd totally forgotten about, shame on me. I kept thinking of, and Carl Wadegi is going to know this, right? In Australia recently, they had this Kentucky Fried Chicken challenge. So you know the Kentucky Fried Chicken bargain bucket of chicken that normally has KFC branding on it that's red? They changed it to the Australian cricket colours of green and gold.
Green and gold.
And all the Australian cricket fans around the stadiums were wearing these upside down turned KFC buckets on their head. And they were called the Bucket Head Army. So I just had this picture of a guy in like medieval sort of, you know, boiled leather and breastplates with like a KFC bucket on his head.
Yeah. Thank Buckethead you, Australia, just played in Boston. Nice. Buckethead, the guitarist. That was
There's
in...
a guitarist called Buckethead?
Yeah. He played for like the revamped Guns N' Roses instead of Slash. And he wore an upside down KFC bucket. Buckethead.
To go back to the Mountain Clans, I think one of the reasons John thinks they will be willing to go with Stannis, that's actually just what we were saying, is that they are not involved in politics of the North as much as the other houses, and so they don't fear the Iron Throne. Vengeance. They don't care what Tommen thinks of them. They will be just happy to fight and to protect the North against the Iron Man first and then Bolton. And that's just in their character. They're kind of easier to deal with, I guess.
Yeah, they're pretty hardcore, huh? Like, yeah. I love them. They give zero fucks.
I also think it's a good opportunity to get rid of a bunch of greybeards, as, Big Bucket points out, you know, I want to die this winter, I'm not going to survive it, you know, might as well go out in a blaze of glory.
Yeah, Big Bucket's so fucking good as a character. I hope he does awesome and wins.
Yeah.
So going...
What would you guys have done if you were John? Would you have given the weaponry? I just feel that's like a step too far. You can feed people. That's like humanitarian, to give them food and shelter. I feel just giving even like basic level... Oh, well, I'm not giving them plate, but they can have the boiled leather. It just felt... Oh.
It's too early to trust them with that, I think.
Yeah. Oh, but maybe John... I mean, what would have happened if he would have said no? They would have just taken it anyway.
Yeah, I think the weapons... if I were him, like, the weapons seem like the lesser of two evils, right? Because food is going to run out in winter, regardless. Like, you can always make more swords.
But the difference is that the food is used for them to survive, whereas the weaponry is going to be used against one side or other in this war. So the food doesn't break neutrality, but the weaponry does somehow.
I think that one of the difficulties here is that all the other kings are not there. Stannis is. And, well, there's not much that Jon can do to stop him from taking what he wants to take. So maybe it's just easier to give him a bit, at least.
Which is part of his problem, though, because he's, like, for the PR, he has to say, well, okay, I'm giving this away or whatever, right? And he makes up reasons as to why they're doing it. But then from the outside, to people, that looks like he is taking a part. It looks like he doesn't want to look weak by saying, well, I've got to give them stuff. You know, he doesn't want it to be taken. But at the same time, like, you know, it sort of leads to his ouster at the end, right?
Yeah, but to be fair, he does take part. I mean, this whole dialogue with Stannis, it's him advising him about what to do in the war
He's not careful enough to, like, the rest of the men at the Night's Watch to make it look like he's not taking part, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he could take steps to make it look more begrudging and to make it look like, you know, well, they're taking it, there's nothing we can do, guys, you know, but he doesn't do that. Instead, it's maybe, you know, his pride in a way where he's like, well, yes, okay, we're giving Stannis this, or we're going to help Stannis with that. And he's just ordering them around like they're in step, you know?
Yeah.
The optics don't look good.
Yeah.
I think
at the same time, Stannis just saved their bacon. So, like, it's not like they willfully interfered with him or sided with him. Stannis showed up and, like, won their cause for him, and then now he's asking for concessions.
I agree, and I think most people agree, but, you know, there's definitely people in the Night's Watch, and then, of course, people to the south that just see that as they've joined forces.
Fucking Bowen Marsh. God damn it.
I know, I hate him so much now when I see his pomegranate face, and he's such a little whiny bitch. He's like, you're eating the food too much.
I think one of the issues is that John doesn't have the John doesn't have the respect of his men. I mean, now everything is possible. The old bear was actually killed by his own men, so it's like the Lord Commander doesn't have the same ring to it as before. It doesn't.
Once you've committed a coup, then once God is dead, everything is permitted, right?
Yeah, you know? Exactly. So
yeah, it's lost a bit of the shine. But then, like, you got to think too. Is like, how did he become Lord Commander, right? So, I mean, it's not necessarily like everyone was like, yeah, John. Like, there was a bit of trickery involved, and afterwards some people might feel a certain way about that.
So you're saying he won the Electoral College, but not the popular vote?
Yeah, 100%. And I kind of feel like sending Sam away, well, I get why he had to do it for the story, was a bad move, because Sam had a political awareness. And it just leaves him so exposed. I discussed this in an earlier episode, but I think it's a real misstep. And it just means...
Well, both Sam and Aemon at the same time.
Exactly. He's now just blundering around blind without any real allies. And you just see that in this chapter, that every way he thinks, like the way he just blurts out home truths at Stannis, there's no attempt to soften them. He just doesn't... He's a bit like Ned. He has a complete inability to play the game, and he's going to pay the ultimate price. And I guess that's the point, right? That's the parallel with Dany and Meereen. They're both going to end up in a very desperate pass. But it's painful watching him doing it, because you just think, you know, your father ended up dead, right? Lessons learned.
Yeah, but at the same time, I didn't quite see. Yeah, I don't quite see what he could do, really. I mean, I agree that sending Sam away and all of his other friends, by the way, was probably not the great move. But in this chapter and also in previous and in a few chapters again, he actually listens to what Bo and Marsh says. And he's like, I'm taking this into account. I will think about it. We will find a solution. He's trying to manage everything and he has to take hard decisions. I mean, the whole wildling thing, he has to, I mean, he needs the wall to be manned, so he's going to take whatever he can to have people watching. But at the same time, his own men are not going to accept that. And I feel like there's not a lot he could have done to soften the blow and make it more subtle and more PR. Like, I don't really see how he could have made it better. Maybe I'm too honest, but...
Yeah, it's a rock and a hard place.
It's a genuinely tricky position to be in. And I think that's deliberate on George's part. He's showing how hard it is to rule. And, you know, I guess he's making this macro point about how fantasy stories traditionally ended with our popular hero being made a king. Lord of the Rings, anyone? But then you never see them actually having to deal with ruling. Like, it's easy to show the battle. And we've seen Robert fail after he won. And now we're seeing Danny and John fail in different
ways. And fail spectacularly.
Yeah, exactly.
But isn't it just because they've been fighting the wildlings now that he is failing? Like, if there's any survivors from, like, the Fist of the First Men, don't they realize, like, the bigger enemy out there? Like, I don't, like, that's why Bowen Marsh, because of that fucking Bridge of Skulls bullshit, he's, like, against everything that John's doing with the wildlings when he knows that the bigger threat is out there.
I think that's one of the points in that the survivors of the First Men are greatly outnumbered by, like, the stewards, and their primary experience has been the wildlings. So, yeah, they see all these actions that John's doing, and they're like, why are you doing this? The wildlings are our enemy. And
yeah,
they
plus
refuse.
They're stewards. They're not rangers. Like,
yeah, they
suck. They're not out there fighting. Ugh. Whatever. Getting angry.
I mean, that's a valid response, I feel. There's a lot to be angry about in this situation. But I do think the good thing about this chapter is you do start to see the sort of military tactical stuff that John has that Stannis doesn't. I mean, there's lots of interesting insight into where they are and their relative perceptiveness and insights, but it's...
Yeah, but do you think that's John's, like, better understanding or just, like, local knowledge that he's, like... You know, well, like, on paper, it sounds like a good idea, and I can see, like, why you'd want to attack the Dreadfort, but you haven't seen it, like, you know.
It doesn't really matter if it's local knowledge or not. At least he has an appreciation for topography and how it works, and Stannis is the moron for not listening to him. Like, if you have a military man in front of you who's fought genuine battles, as you have, but who knows the local ground and the local people, wouldn't you really take advantage of that rather than commanding his subservience, threatening him when he doesn't comply, and then just ignoring him because you're hell bent on some scheme anyway?
Well,
he does in the end, but it's just kind of like, he's such a cocky shit. It's really weird. I sort of go through these sort of changes of temperament towards Stannis. Like, I think when I first read the books, I really wasn't Team Stannis. And then people like Amin persuaded me, and I was like, oh, well, he does. But on this reread, I'm actually really somehow focusing on the negatives.
Yeah, but, I mean, yeah, what you're saying is correct. But at the same time, don't you take anything coming from, like, a 16-year-old's mouth as, like, you know, the grain of salt?
A 16-year-old in this world, where 16-year-olds do rule and are declared kings. And it's just sort of, like, coupling this with the next chapter, the Davos chapter, where he's like, whenever anyone asks him a sticky question, he's like, I have to answer like Stannis. Stannis wouldn't want me to lie. Like, in his head, he has this image of Stannis still as this upright man of brilliance. But at the end of the day, they're asking straightforward questions like, won't we have to adopt this new red god's, you know, this red god and people will die? And he knows it to be true. He knows the truth about Stannis and that Stannis isn't this man. But he's still clinging on to the belief. And I think in both of these chapters, you're seeing the reality of Stannis, which is that he is very stubborn. He's very entitled. He doesn't always have the best instincts and the best decisions and plans. And he's very fickle. He needs to be flattered, and he's very fickle. Like, he was, like, hell-bent on this plan, now he's going to do this other plan, but I don't know. He's not a person who here would follow Stannis in the way that Davos does. Like, does he inspire you as a leader? Are there any
more than Cersei?
Oh, yeah.
Well, if it's Stannis or the Boltons, it's like, well, geez.
Yeah, maybe best of a bad bunch. But I find him hypocritical, and I feel that with Cersei or Ramsay, at least I know where I stand. Like, there's no side to them. Whereas Stannis is just, he and some of his supporters have just drunk the Kool-Aid. And the reality is actually far murkier and nastier than they'd like to believe.
Yeah, my main issue with Stannis is the religion one. Like, he has no... I mean, I believe that he himself doesn't really care about which religion he follows, but he doesn't understand that that's actually an issue for the population and to have followers. And that's my main thing.
To me, it's like, yeah. What does he truly believe the realm is? Like, everything he says he's doing is for the realm, a bit like Varys, right? But it's bullshit. What is the realm other than a collection of people that you're trying to keep safe or protect or rule? And if doing it for the realm and your right to rule includes, well, but the only way I can achieve that is by, you know, empowering this red priestess and burning a bunch of people alive. Like, at what point is it, do you get some self-awareness about the fact that you're trying to, you know, you think you'll be the best ruler or just the most righteous ruler and the fairest ruler, and yet you're going to kill a bunch of people for religious bigotry? And even worse, right, for a religion that you probably personally don't believe in anyway. Like, it's bad enough when, you know, Queen Mary in England is burning Protestants alive, and when, you know, the Protestants burning Catholics alive. And maybe you'll say it's not better, but at least they believed what they were doing was genuinely, like, he's doing it for no reason.
No, I don't think he's doing it for no reason. I think he is aware of Melisandre's power, and maybe there's no religion behind it in his mind. Maybe he doesn't believe in the ideology, but he has seen what her powers can do. And, I mean, they got to the wall with these swift winds from the south because supposedly she burnt whichever Florence it was. And I mean, that might not actually be true, but I think he does believe in this power, and that's why he's letting her burn people.
Okay, so he believes in her as a sorceress, if not a religious leader.
Yeah.
At least all the people he burns, they're not innocents. Like, they've done some form of treason, and they were going to be executed anyway. Can't believe I'm vouching for someone who burns people. But...
yeah. Cool.
And to be fair, he does... I was going to say, to be fair, he does change his entire strategy based on Jon Snow's advice, this is a really good what if. You know, what if he had marched on the Dreadfort? The entire trajectory of A Dance with Dragons would be different.
Well, let's unpack that a little bit. Talk about what is your alternative history? This is fascinating stuff. I love this.
Stannis goes south. The Boltons are aware of his presence, and as John says, they do the signal fires. The Boltons come up, and Stannis gets cut to pieces, I believe.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Also, if he takes the wildlings, then the Umbers are going to fight him as well. So, yeah.
So what ultimately changes in terms of where we are right now in Dance? I mean, well, Stannis is still on the throne. The only credible army in person against her is gone. John is out of a pickle because he doesn't have Stannis hovering over him. The Boltons are ascendant.
Long live the Boltons.
Yeah. But does it really change? How would it change what you think will happen in T-Well? Just not having Stannis and his army around?
I think it makes a big difference for the Northern arc, the whole conspiracy. Because if, like, at some point, like, we know that Manderly isn't going to stay true to Bolton. But if he doesn't have Stannis to join, I don't think that's going to be as easy. Not that it's going to be easy anyway. So it changes a lot of things, at least for the North. But true, that doesn't mean it's going to change anything for the rest of the realm. Things seem to be quite disconnected at the moment. Like, it's chaos everywhere. So everyone is just taking care of its own chaos at the time.
Yeah, the North and the South are two different entities at this point, below the neck and above the neck.
Yeah, and they're led by the worst, the Boltons, the Freys, and the Lannisters.
I had just a small thing about this chapter. In the first Davos chapter, we get the story of Ned going through Sister Town and being brought by this fisherman's daughter and the whole...
Who he knocks up.
Yeah, apparently. I mean, and there's a reference, not a reference, but something that could be a reference to that in that chapter is when Stannis says, "Did Ned Stark father you and some fishwife?" And that's obviously just a jape because of the way Jon is negotiating. But that's like sounded like a reference to that story to me.
And he even mentions Davos in this chapter. He's like, "Oh, Davos might be at White Harbor by now." So I thought that was nice.
Yeah. Well, he also believes him dead, so...
True.
I mean, believes he might be dead, at least, because he's got no news from him.
Right, and by all accounts, he is, like, after the next chapter we go over, because don't they send a raven immediately to King's Landing saying, or the phrase do, that saying that the Davos's head and hands are mounted up on the gates, like, or something?
Release that boy, come on.
Yep. God damn it.
Okay.
So, Michael, you like people that burn other people alive, is what I heard?
If it's for the right reasons, you know, like to get favorable winds or to wake a stone dragon, you get a case. And if the people are treasonous, so a lot of ifs.
But there is a time where it's like okay to burn people.
In time of war.
In some cases, in an existential crisis against the long night.
Great. Okie dokie. So after John 4, which, again, I just think it's a great chapter, we move, which takes place on March 8th. We skip over a Tyrion chapter to Davos 3, which takes place on March 12th. And it's Adam with a chapter summary? Or is it Matt? Who decided to do it in the end?
Oh, I got it.
It's Adam.
Awesome balls. Jon Snow, take it away.
Hey, Matt, you can just read from Tower of the Hand, where there is nothing.
But there's nothing.
Right. Okay, so, hold on, let me pull it up here. Yep, Davos 3. Davos appears before Manderly's court. He's first introduced to, I think, his cousin, Sir Marlon Manderly, takes him to meet Wyman. Davos notes that there are very few men remaining at the court. I think he says it's about 5-1 women to men, but there are quite a few Freys in the Merman's court, which is not cool. He notices that Lord Manderly doesn't look great. I mean, you know, which makes sense. He's quite large and he's been under a lot of stress. So, let's see. He knows that they want him to kneel, but he has come before them as the hand of the king, and he doesn't think that's right to kneel, so he decides not to. Davos pokes fun at Manderly's weight after they call him out for being a smuggler, and they kind of trade some insults and shit there, and it's a little fun. Davos challenges the Freys as murderers of Manderly's son, but the Freys claim that it was all Rob who turned into a wolfman, and also many of his friends turned into a wolfman, because you know when your wolfman bites you, it spreads, so obviously that's what happened, and then they had to put him down for the good of everyone else. Rob betrayed them and nothing else happened. You can suck it. So Davos is unfazed by the threats that the Freys have posed on him and calls them all liars. He also declares Tommen is a bastard child of incest, and that shit's not cool, so Stannis is the real king. But they're like, fuck that. Sir Willis's wife proclaims they're still loyal to King's Landing, of course, because, you know, her husband is their prisoner. And Davos assumes that's why she says it. Let's see. Lord Wyman tells Davos that the terms offered by the Freys and Boltons, and as well as King's Landing, are quite favorable. He gets his son back. He gets peace. And what does Davos offer? Davos tells him that... what does he say? Oh, he says that, Stannis can only offer them a chance to do their duty, and they don't really like that so much. They point out that that's just going to bring more death, which Davos agrees with, but it will also bring death to their enemies, the people that betrayed them, betrayed the King of the North. Vengeance. Let's see. Then we finally get to the young green-haired Wyla Manderly, who's the only one brave enough to speak up in support of Stannis, or well, more in support of Rob. It reminds them all how the Manderlys have been faithful to the Starks for over 1,000 years, declaring that Robb needs to be avenged, and they don't like that. Let's see, Rhaegal Frey counters that the Starks are actually with the Boltons because Ramsay is marrying Arya, and that makes it all cool, except we know that's bullshit. And then the court seems to kind of get behind that for a little bit until she is removed, and Lord Manderly says, "Off with his head," and they take him to the Wolf's Den.
The North does tend to specialise in these really badass 10-year-old girls who take no shit.
Every noble family has one.
It's like you think Arya is just so cool and awesome. Like Willa Manderly and Lyanna Mourne are kind of like what Arya would have been had she not gone off and become a little psycho killer and had PTSD and all sorts of crap happen to her. She would have just been another one of these feisty northern women or these feisty northern girls who are just... You know, she's not in on whatever Grand Northern conspiracy is going on. Her parents are just, like, excruciated by the fact she keeps on saying stuff they all know is true. And she doesn't give a shit. She just keeps on saying it. Yeah. It's brilliant. Until, like, her mom grabs her by the braids and takes her off.
They clearly raise capable women in the North. I mean, not entirely. But, I mean, Lyanna Stark. I mean, there's plenty of evidence of women in the North being a bit more... having a bit more agency, not that anyone
absolutely.
Has a ton in this world.
Sansa Stark is definitely unusual. I think when I started watching Game of Thrones in particular, but reading the books, you just think Arya is just this very unusually, precociously badass girl. But she's not. It's Sansa who's unusual and is more Tully and more sort of southern than this. That was my main takeaway. Just absolute brilliance of Willa.
And she's got the cool green hair and she's kind of a badass. Now, I haven't gotten to the later chapters yet in the rereads. It's been a while. Does she just do this on her own? I mean, like, later on, I know that Lord Manderly calls her brave, but, like, was he telling her to say this, or was this just,
I think,
like,
she
had to, right?
No, I think she's just being feisty. She's like, what is this shit? I'm not marrying this stupid Frey betrayer. I haven't read ahead, actually. I am reading the reread as we do the chapters, but it's,
It's been a couple of years, so I don't remember.
Yeah, I think when, Wyman's doing the North Remembers kind of speech, he's like, yes, Willis, like, she's always, like, the strong one and whatever. And he says it, like, with pride and not, like, you know, oh, I told her to say
it. He definitely praises her, but, I mean, like, it doesn't matter, I guess, in the end. But, I mean, yeah, if she's doing this just kind of like, what the fuck, and she's not in on any of it, like, it makes her even more badass, I think.
This is such a good other person... chapter.
So yeah, the only other person who's in on it besides Lord Manderly is the other sister who drags her out by the hair. Those are the only two people.
Right, okay.
I like how Davos is like, there goes my only ally in the court.
poor Davos here, man. When you read this the first time, I mean, we hear about how his head's been in a pike, and then you get through this chapter and you're like, oh shit, Davos is about to die. Like, were you fooled, or did you think, you know, something else was going to happen?
I think we talked about this on the last one where we did Davos 1. But yeah, I was like, oh, well, there goes Davos.
Yeah, Manderly makes really good arguments, or maybe it's his maester. He's like, you know, why should we side with Stannis? He's just going to bring us more death and destruction. And I was like, yeah, those are good reasons. I guess you're fucked, Davos.
I like Davos, too, but he's just like, well, then I name you a liar. Like, what would a Frey
also,
know of honor?
doesn't it say that that it says that the Merman's Court is all made of wood? The castle's made of wood? Is that what it said?
No, that can't be right.
I think the castle's white stone, but the hall is all wood, which is strange.
I mean, that's what it was, yeah. Because he notes that, like, everything's wood. So I was like, you know, that's a fire hazard and shit. So maybe they don't have the greatest castle, you know.
I think it's because they have all this weird decoration, don't they? Like, the inside of their castle is almost like a seafaring cabin with lots of sea creatures, like, put into it and stuff. I think it is a stone castle. It's just their interior decor is Norwegian sauna, apparently.
It sounds really tacky. I'm like, ew.
Yeah, it sounds horrid. But, you know, I just love this family so much.
It's like a New England fishing village.
Yeah, they get a free pass on faux
name. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, I know, Vali, you've just done your kitchen like that, haven't you?
I have my nautical room.
You do.
You represent here.
Who doesn't have a nautical room?
Poor people.
People with a more modern style. I don't know. Anyway, but I like the Manderlys, so they get away with it. Who here? I mean, I assume we're all believing in the Grand Northern conspiracy, if one type of another or another.
Yeah, I believe that Manderly's in on it.
Who else do you think is in on it, or who do you think's not in on it?
Everyone
who's
else.
Just playing every side.
Yeah, Karstark. I think the Umbers are in on it.
Karstark, no, but the Umbers, yeah.
I feel like everyone else but the Manderlys are sort of opportunists, and that they're pissed off at the Boltons, but at some level they might go along with it. Whereas Manderly is the only diehard loyal, which makes them all the more better.
Well,
but I think they make the argument.
Mormonts. They're outright hostile. That's right.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, they make the argument in this chapter that, like, every northern house lost someone at the Red Wedding to the Boltons and Freys. So why, I mean, at some level, the house has got to be willing to go against Boltons at like the slightest, you know, showing of like Stark or like some kind of opposition that they can join.
I think they're trying to be very practical, which is why you see a couple of the big houses kind of split their forces and kind of support both sides, because it really won't cost them anything to kind of play it out. And then, you know, well, we're going to go with the safe side because there's so much chaos right now. They can just take part in the chaos. And if anything comes up, like let's say the Boltons win, they say, well, you know, we'd always supported the Starks and, you know, some of our family just couldn't let that go yet, but we're still cool, right? Because the rest of our family supported you. So
actually, like John explains it in his chapter, a lot of those families are either connected to the Boltons by marriage or they have a son or a nephew or someone being taken hostage at the Red Wedding. So they also, I mean, when you've already lost people at that thing, you are going to try to get the rest of them safely home, even if it means going with the Boltons. I mean, yeah, I understand that.
How can they show any loyalty? Because between the Red Wedding and like the sacking of Winterfell,
I don't think they're going to really northern show. Houses. I mean, I think one thing that we see in Winterfell in the rest of the book is that they aren't really loyal to Bolton. They just don't really see any alternative at the moment.
Yeah, Stannis is a hopeless cause.
Yeah.
Right. And if he gained enough steam, they would definitely join him.
Yeah, and also, like, we need to remember that it's not said here, it's going to be explained in later chapters, but Manderly knows that Rickon and Bran are not dead. I mean, at least he suspects it, whereas the other lords, we can assume they don't know. So they don't, like, if they don't want to follow Bolton, who are they going to side with? Because Stannis is not a Northern Lord. He's just another pretender to the Iron Throne. And there are no Starks left. So what are they going to do?
I don't know.
Yeah. What one thing I found nice in this chapter is that at the end, Wyman Manderly says, I will not do it, not for you, not for your lord, not for any man. But he will do it for a child, for Rickon.
Oh, that's good. A liege lord.
Yeah. Like, he actually, I think if you carefully, if you look carefully at Manderly's words, I don't think that he really says, I mean, he says he won't join Stannis, and he's obviously doing this whole thing for the benefit of the Freys, but he is also, there are a few indications of what's going to happen.
Yeah, he has some looks that he spots for a second.
So guys, I just realized that House Manderly doesn't have any house words.
Who wants pie?
Yummy, all yummy fish.
We do not bake.
All the lampreys belong to us. So, do you think there's anything going on with Manderly here? Like, Davos says that he looks half a corpse. I mean, we know he's gigantically fat, but, like, half a corpse isn't good either.
Or what, you think, zombie-ish?
I don't know. Do you think maybe he's getting poisoned by the Freys or something?
I think he's being poisoned by diabetes.
I mean, you do call people morbidly obese, right? So I think it's just a turn of phrase. Like, morbidly obese is a thing, so...
Especially in this world where very few people even have the opportunity to become obese, like, period. So, like, he would definitely, I don't know, he would probably appear grotesque, and he's not super healthy, I'm sure.
It might also be foreshadowing that he might not survive this. When you look at some of the later chapters, he gets cut up a bit, and his prognosis doesn't seem good.
But he seems like... I mean, he even makes it, I think it's in the next Davos chapter, where he's like, oh, I'm known for my epically long shits. Like, do you think, I mean, maybe that, like, his maester is poisoning him? Because the maester seems like a little fuckhead, too.
Maybe he eats too much.
Well, we know that.
Maybe.
I'm putting it out there right now. Theory, Manderly's being poisoned by the Freys or his maester, in conjunction with the Freys.
See, at first that seems tinfoil, but it could be the case. And again, I mean, it's not obvious.
Well, the Freys are going to marry into his house anyway, so removing him just puts them closer to owning White Harbor, right?
Huh. Yeah, that almost makes sense.
Yeah. Put one in the wind column for Varley.
Varley in the sailor room.
That's right.
Trying to see if I had anything else on this chapter other than Willa for the win. I do feel bad for Davos.
Gets some good lines.
He gets some good lines. I feel sorry for him because he's just cognitively tying himself into a knot. He wants to behave as Stannis would want him to behave. He wants to behave as the better Stannis wants him to behave, but he has to, you know, he's equivocating so hard because he knows the reality of life under Stannis. And
yeah, and I think the best sign for him when he walks in there is that he notices how many women there are. There's, like he said, it's like 5-1 women to men. Like, that shows how much support White Harbor sent towards Rob, which is also why they have to play this game to get, you know, as many of their people back as possible. But, yeah, it would give him cause to be more hopeful, I would think. But then, you know, they're, like, off his head, so poor guy.
You see the crowd is pissed off. Like, when Willa starts speaking out, they all get worked up. So there's definitely some simmering tensions.
I mean, the balls of Rhaegal, Frey,
Rhaegal,
yeah.
Who's like, man,
turned into
werewolf, bro. You had to be there. You had to be there.
And it's common knowledge that, you know, once one bites another, it spreads. Everyone knows that.
Everyone that was killed, he infected, so we had to kill them too. Like, I'm just like, if I'm in the crowd, I'm just like, I just want to stab this guy right in the nuts. Like, come on.
Yeah, and doesn't even Manderly, like, kind of, like, look at him disgusted as, like, and then, like, has to play his part again?
Yeah.
And those damn Freys, they think they're winning. They think that, everyone's buying it, so.
I mean, this doesn't end well for Rhaegar Frey, right? I don't remember.
He ends up as baked good.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's in the pie.
Yeah.
That is
comforting. If you find yourself inside a pie, you have lost that battle.
V-O-K, P-S-A. If you find yourself inside a pie, you have lost the battle.
Unless it's a giant Trojan surprise pie.
Yeah. Unless you're being served at a wedding feast and you're going to burst out of it and kill the host.
You're going to pop out. Like, that's what they do instead of the cake. they put like a knight, in armor that comes out and he dances for the crowd. Giant pie.
I'd pay good money to see that shit happen.
Burst out of a pie wearing nothing but a sash. You're at a Westerosi party.
Just a coat of arms around the groin.
No, not even that.
Christ alive. Okay. Anything sensible on this chapter?
We have more nonsense for sure.
Shall I round out the actual main body of the...
I don't think I have anything else on this chapter.
It's a short chapter, but it's another great one. I really enjoyed all three chapters, actually. Which, when you get into feast dance, you usually get one sort of, like, trudgingly boring.
Wanting to dud.
But these were all really cool, I felt. Like, good world building, good proper politics, people with tricky choices that aren't good. I love all that kind of stuff. Okie dokie. So that is the end of the main body of the episode. For those of you following along at home, the next episode of the reread will cover Cersei 4 from Feast, Tyrion 4 and Bran 2 from Dance. Host TBD. If Matt has edited Mindhunter by then, maybe it'll be Matt, but we don't know. It's all.
We don't, and no one can tell. When I look into the flames, I see nothing.
How's the editing of Mindhunter going? Have you even just looked to see if the file is okay?
I haven't even checked to see if the file even sounds good.
Oh.
Have you checked to see if you have a program that will edit?
I do. It's, what is it? What would you give me, Bina? Audacity?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really funny because I feel this Mindhunter podcast mentioning has been going on for decades because, first of all, there are about 15 episodes where when I say, has anyone got any episodes they want to pimp out? Matt's like, yeah, I really want to do a Mindhunter episode. And now there's going to be about another 15 episodes where it's like, Matt, did you edit the Mindhunter episode yet?
So are we going to get Mindhunter first or the Winds of Winter?
Oh, good question. I'd have to put my money on Georgia at this point.
Another, like, 7 years to be on par with Georgia.
We're going to get mind fire and blood first.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, you'll get something completely unnecessary beforehand.
But that is a great segue. Do any of you have any forthcoming episodes that you want to pimp out?
Oh, yeah. We'll be recording episode 70 soon.
That is behind the curve. I think Sarah's already done 72, so I'm not that far ahead.
when are you recording 70?
Next weekend.
Next week, yeah.
Okay. Cinco de Mayo.
Saturday or Sunday.
Well, Cinco de Derby. Kentucky Derby's on Saturday, too.
Oh, is it?
I really want to go to the Kentucky Derby 1 year and drink mint juleps.
There might be something on Infinity War, perhaps.
Oh, okay, cool.
I still need to see that movie.
I've raised the gauging interest call, for Jessica Jones season 2. I think quite a lot of people would be interested. I just have to figure out the scheduling and stuff.
Oh, I would listen the hell out of that. Well, thank you all for joining. We've done the next episode's chapters. You can follow us along on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, iTunes, WordPress by searching for Vassals of Kingsgrave or VOK Podcast. As ever, if you want to join in the discussion, maybe jump on an episode sometime, you need to search for a podcast of Ice and Fire and join the forums, and that's the way you can jump onto forthcoming episodes. So thank you very much all for joining. That was like a bunch of fun. We had a good crew and some good chapters, so absolutely the best combination. And thank you for joining. Bye.
Thanks, Bina.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Okay.
So, Adam, what happened with Ice and Fire Con?
What do you mean?
Like, how come you're not there? How come you're on this? Not that we're not absolutely, you know, super thrilled and excited to have you here. It's just that we would have thought you would be more super thrilled and excited to be there.
Yeah, I was gonna go. Yeah.
So what happened?
Didn't happen. Well, like I was just been busy and I've been putting it off because like whatever. Like I hadn't bought like passes and stuff yet, and so I went on like Saturday, like the 21st, and it said, oh, like they'd stop selling tickets on the 20th, and I was like, really? Are you fucking kidding me? And so like I emailed them and they never got back to me. I was like, yeah, I didn't realize it closed or whatever. You know, I mean, if it had been like halfway across the country, I probably would have like bought like planes and all that shit like well beforehand, but it's only a couple hours from me, so.
Bought planes? I was
not really too stressed about that.
A whole plane?
Yep, would have bought whole planes because that's how I roll. But yeah, so I was like, whatever. I'm like, I guess I can't go, but I was like, well, I'll just post and I'll see like, hey, is there anyone that's not going and like, you know. Like, I'll buy your tickets or whatever. And they were like, yeah, you can't do that. That's too much work for us. We can't possibly do that right now.
I mean, they're not like, Comic-Con. Okay. I can't imagine they get that many people asking them to reassign tickets. That seems like a... And given, like, how many people Podcast of Ice and Fire and Vox sends, you think maybe they would just be a bit nice to us? Because we send, like, 30, 40 people,
super
right?
minor.
That
and
just
I
seems very petty.
I sent an email to her, and I sent an email to Amin, and, like, they never responded. So that's why I posted the thing. There were several people that were like, oh, yeah, you can just have them. That's fine. You know? And I was like, oh, no, I'm like, well, I offered to pay them for tickets. Like, so a bunch of people posted, they're like, yeah, we can't go. And then they were like, we can't deal with all these refunds right now. You can only get a refund if it's like an emergency. And then people were like, well, we're not asking for refunds. Seems... Like, right. Yeah, so I was kind of like, I was like, that's kind of lame. And then they posted right afterwards was like, please don't anyone post on the Facebook group anymore. You know, I only want official stuff on here because I don't have to scroll down and like through messages or whatever. And
wow, if for some reason, like, stick up out of then, your ass. I mean, that is.
And then they were
shit.
Like, yeah, because it's, I'm like, it's too much work for you to scroll down through a Facebook group. Okay. And then if, and we'll cut all this out, but.
I'm not cutting all this out because I think it's actually a good PSA for people. Like, you know, we want to support Ice and FireCon and it is really cool. And people from VOK have like amazing times there. So you should all go and have fun. But just when you buy your ticket, I guess the PSA is when you buy your ticket, bear in mind that you may not be able to get a refund. So just be sure that you want to go.
And it says, and well, that's part of the thing. It says that in the policy, which is part of the reason why, like, I booked off the time from work, which I never take off time from work. Like, 6 months ago, but like I don't really find out until like a month or two before. So like in, you know, February or whatever, the thing had gotten approved and I was like, okay, great, you know. So I mean, I would have made it work like either way, but it says like, you know, if you buy tickets, we don't do refunds, yada yada yada. So I was like, well, I'll just hold off because like it's not like they're gonna sell out or whatever. And you know, it's just a whole bunch of things. But anyway, so yeah, they posted like, yeah, don't anyone post it, you know, for a while. I'm like, well, that's weird. And then it was like, yeah, and if for some reason, you know, if you bought, you know, a hotel or tickets or you know, airplane tickets or whatever, and you don't have passes for some reason, you know, email me, you know, don't show up, just email me. So it's like, oh, so you could have fixed it if you wanted to, but you decided like you just didn't want to do it.
Are they a profit-making organization or like?
I don't think so.
That just seems like very poor customer services.
Right. And I mean, and in all fairness, it's like, yeah, I should have done it like in advance, and I would have, and just, you know, life and shit have been busy. And like, I was trying to get my wife to just come with me, and then I was going to book a hotel like at the thing, and we could just kind of hang out half the time and have a little vacation, but she wasn't really into it. So I was like, whatever. But like, there were rooms there. It's like, I had a room booked like off site, and then there was actually rooms there. I was like, well, I'll just switch it to the lodge or whatever. And they were like, well, no, you can't get passes. So I was like, okay, well, I'll just cancel my room and shit. That's you know, yeah. And then I'm like, whatever, you know.
I'm pretty unimpressed.
Don't get to be one of the cool kids this year. That's okay. I'll live.
I think that's pretty unimpressive. I mean, like, how many people turn up? It's not that big a thing. So.
Right. It's not like suddenly hundreds of people were going to be like causing you trouble. It's like, you know, one person. I mean, my thing is like maybe they didn't want like the cascade of people being like, well, hey, can I get a refund or something? You know. But at the same time, like they already said they don't do that, and I emailed them directly, and they never responded. So. You know, I didn't think it was a big deal, but it was like, oh, it's obvious it's too late for us to help you. I was like, okay, sure.
You're in a consumer services oriented industry, sort your shit out. That's unimpressive to me.
And I mean, again, I agree. I think it's pretty shitty. And it's not like I feel like entitled to like that they have to help me or whatever. Or, you know, I didn't buy the tickets in time. Whatever,
but they should at least say, but like, oh, you didn't buy the tickets on time. Like, they could have sent a
message to me, or they could have, their message could have been like, oh, sorry, we just can't. It's just like, whatever. Like I said, it's not, you know, it's as much my fault as anything, but it's still kind of, I felt it was rude.
I think it's,
you know, I was not impressed.
Poor brand management from whoever organizes it. You're not Comic-Con. You're not that busy to answer people's
right.
emails.
And, well, and the thing is those conventions that are that busy would do it. You know what I mean? Would be much simpler to do. And actually, at most conventions like that, you can just, like, it doesn't even involve them at all. You just find someone who's like, yeah, I've already got my passes ready to go. And, like, you just get it from them. And,
this, like, is they, why you know, I don't sound. Why they don't you check can sell it to someone else on the, like, secondary market? Like, why do you need to involve them?
Right, like that's what you do for other conventions, even smaller conventions, bigger conventions. It's usually pretty simple to just, all you need is a confirmation code and shit, and you go pick up your stuff. I mean, if it says someone else's name, like I said, they're not usually checking your ID or anything anyway. And if they do, like, who cares, you know? Like, Comic-Con has hundreds of thousands of people that roll through there, and they try to do that where they say, well, you have to have your ID, you know, so that, like, scalpers won't buy it and sell it. But I've never once actually had them, like, check my ID against my reservation. They don't have time for that.
Yeah. Oh, well, anyway, all's well that ends well, I suppose. You ended up being with us and having the coolest Sunday ever.
No. That's right.
Ever.
Ever.
And I still got time off to just do fuck all and get things done around the house, so, you know.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's fine.
Michael just left.